Okay, we're in studio now with Brendan Devaney, presenter of the DL Debate podcast. Hi, Brendan.
What about you, Greg?
How are you getting on?
I am the very best.
Right, this is a particularly busy weekend. Lots of championships started at the weekend, and there's more to look forward to. And, of course, there's the big story about Jim McGuinness's imminent return to Donegal.
Jimmy's
winning
matches.
Where do you want to start?
My throat's a wee bit croaky this morning. I was going to sing Jimmy's Winning Matches.
No, you're right. We've got people. We'll get Rory Gallagher to do that.
Rory Gallagher. It's an interesting name to throw out there.
The Revs?
Yeah, the Revs. Yeah, and which one you met?
Yeah, all right. Come here. So it's a done deal now. There's a meeting amongst clubs this evening. It's an interesting one. Like, you know, I only want to be positive about it, but it'll be interesting to see how he reflects on this in a year or two.
Yeah, as ever, from the last process, I suppose, Greg, we were looking for somebody like a front runner, someone who we really wanted to get the job. The people we approached last time, nobody seemed to want it, and then we pulled together this management team and went on to have a very tough season. So for someone like Jim to come back into the picture, it's absolutely massive, and I think this is going for quite a few weeks now, Greg. Even probably by the time the selection committee was assembled, there was a strong rumour that Jim was in the background. Maybe they were assembled in case that didn't work, but it seemed to be from a good few weeks back that I'd heard that they were in talks. Once they're in talks, a lot of people can't understand what's the issue, but there's a lot of finer detail in here, Greg. You know, obviously Jim's coming in full time. That needs to be sorted. You know, his backroom team has to be unbelievably professional and who he wants, and that costs a lot of money. You know, you're on about top S&C, nutrition, doctors, physios. So
you're looking at a few hundred grand anyway.
Yeah, but that's it. And he's going to want guarantees that's there. Now, the minute last year, listen, obviously with everything happened in Donegal, fundraising didn't really happen. So at the minute, finances aren't great in the county, but they will be when Jim comes on, they'll get behind him. So I suppose they had to tease out what he would have needed in terms of his team and his backroom team and who that's going to be versus what the deal's going to be. So it's not just Jim comes in, you tick a box, he's the manager. There's quite a few things to put in place.
He's got a wish list as well.
That's it.
So let me ask you this, in your view, what brought him back? What does he see there? Because, you know, he knows expectations. Now, he'll come out and he'll manage expectations, but he knows where expectations will be at. And we discussed this a little bit last year. I mean, like, is an Ulster enough? I don't know if it is anymore, right? So, but you know more than I, as everyone knows. But, like, what does he see in the county, do you think, that he says, right, I can do something here? Because he wouldn't come back otherwise, would he?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing, I guess, that he had to kind of maybe put the soccer side of his life to bed. I know that obviously where he was, that journey went on, Greg, between being over at Glasgow Celtic in terms of his roles there. You know, he'd overforced his performance in that with under 20s and he took his coaching badges then, and then he ended up getting a number two job going out to China. It's a phenomenal story. He ends up then at Charlotte. You know, you look at Charlotte now, they're in the top flight MLS where Messi's playing. You know, he was so close to that. So when he came back here then, you know, he still was doing about Derry City, and I think he still was looking about potentially taking a soccer job. You know,
well, his name was linked to the Finn Harp shop.
Yeah, that's it. Whether it be League Ireland or wherever, Irish League or something. But this didn't seem to materialise. Now, obviously, he was doing a bit with Down last year, and he had offered to help out with if Rory Cavan and Carl Lacey had taken the job, to be part of their management team, if you like. Now that he at that stage, I suppose, was kind of thinking about coming back. But for him now, looking at it, maybe he's decided, right, it's time to come back in. I think it's a brilliant time for him to come in, because there were so many players missing last year that'll come back. The lads that have come in, particularly in the championship, you know, really showed their merit and their skills. So, you know, if you're putting a team, listen, we beat Monaghan with a side which was missing a host of players. They ran Dublin right close to the last few minutes of the game. So you'd think of putting those players in, you know, we're certainly going to be a match again for Tyrone's and for, you know.
And he's got a godlike status, let's put it like that. He's going to get an extra 5-10% on any player.
At least, I would say even more.
Because of who he is.
Yeah, I mean, in fairness, I would have to say again, fair play to, like, Malachy Roark and Paddy Bradley, and that they did somehow turn Donegal's fortunes around last year. And I think it was one of the best quotes of last year was Malachy Roark after we lost to Tyrone, saying, I'm going to go down, going to go and lie in a dark room for about a week now. I mean, the stress and the pressure must have been immense on him.
But listen, they did a great job. So yeah. McGuinness comes in on a what? 3 years minimum?
Well, I think that's another bit of small. There's word about...
But no point in one-year rollers. That's not good.
I would say, Greg, really, it's his job for as long as he wants it. Mm. I mean, let's be honest, Greg. Let's just look at the scenario if Jim isn't in. We're back to this scenario of we approached a few people last year. I know we might approach some of them, sounded them out this year. Mm-hmm. There's very few candidates out there, and there's none like him. Mm. So, I mean, the fact that he's in there now, the lift it'll give the lads, the players... the whole county, the finances are running behind him, because when people see, it's like a spiral effect, Greg. When things start he'll to go down, when there's turmoil, nobody wants to know. And then when it builds up again, everybody gets back on board.
Would he have any demands, expectations or inquiries as it relates to the structure of how the sport is run in this county?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. People aren't on with Carol Lacey. John Carol Lacey's up working with Kilcoo at the minute. The word on the street is that he isn't going to join them. I thought that would have been a nice fit then, because Carol was very well got as a coach in Bonner's time. But yeah, for him, I think that, Greg, there's no doubting our fortunes will go up. His organisation, now people say the game has moved on as well, but he'll be ready for that. I think his love of Donegal we have to put in there, his attitude and his I suppose what he brings to it in terms of who he is and the knowledge that he has, and so the lift that he's going to give everybody there is going to be huge.
But maybe not locally, but certainly nationally, eyes will be on what kind of football he plays, because you know there is a lot of feeling out there that he introduced a certain type of football, albeit successful, that really. The legacy of it, we're only probably starting to shake now.
Yeah.
Well, was that phrased okay?
Yeah.
I'm trying to be really careful here.
You can't. It's obviously things is always evolving.
Yeah.
And listen, his tactic changed the whole game. You know, three Ulsters, Greg, we couldn't get across the line in Ulster. He won 3 in 4 years, two All-Ireland finals, won one, lost one in Ireland. You know, you'd have to say that as the football has changed, now he's going to be very much aware of that, in terms of that you have to get to a certain mark. Like he was stopping teams scoring maybe 12 points in that, and we were always going to be, that was the game plan, hit them on the counter-attack. Now everybody's got wise to that. Mm. So what you're seeing even with Donegal this year, the breaking out from defence is the key, the fitness and the ability of everybody to be able to contribute going forward, whether it be being on the ball or putting the ball over the bar. So I think he'll be very aware, but we have the players to do that.
I'd imagine he'll set really high standards for players to be part of this squad as well, in terms of availability for training or travelling or things like that there. Because to compete with Dublin, everything's centred closely in terms of travelling for training, conditioning, physio, all that type of stuff. I'm not sure any county can really truly take them on in the long run unless you can get close to what they're doing off the pitch.
Yeah. Oh, it's huge.
So it'll be interesting to see
in a big county
what demands he might have in that regard.
With players like away at different places, college, working, you know, particularly the boys coming down from Dublin, there is always that element to it. But certainly you're on about commitment. There's no doubting that things is going to rise. You know, you look at the 4 years with Donegal, there did seem to be after that, you know, a few people were affected by the heavy training. Maybe there was a wee bit of a lag after it from his time. So, but that's the focus he brings. It's all about here and now, and it's your life's dedicated to the team, and that's it, and that's the way it's going to be. But the lads will revel in that, Greg, because
of course,
you ask any footballer, give me a block of a few years where it's absolutely hands on, and the county's all behind it, and there's a lift. But there's coaches, you know, outside of Carroll, obviously, likes of Mark McHugh's down with Roscommon, but Paul Durkin and Colin McFadden, his brother-in-law, is in training with Sligo. You know, you obviously have likes of Eamon McGee and McLoone involved in the 20s, and so there's a load of lads from his time.
Yeah,
you know,
and you know what's really interesting is, firstly, players will believe that they can win an All Ireland under him, that the glory days can come back.
Yeah,
they'll genuinely believe that. Yeah. But second to that as well, it's almost a perfect time for him to come in, because there is a transition. There is the 2012 boys that are going to be maturing into that role into the future as well. So you could argue that this, if all goes well, bodes well for a generation almost. Yeah. Because maybe Michael Murphy might be ready whenever Jim decides. I know I'm getting ahead of myself here, don't get me wrong, but it's nice to be looking forward where there's you can see a path. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Rather than it being a scramble just to find out who might actually want to take a job. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I'll tell you, because of, you know, you look at the candidates that we would have had ready, a lot of them guys I mentioned, they were all doing bits and pieces of coaching, but they wouldn't be ready to take the Donegal job as such. Outside of a Rory Kavanagh and a Carey Lacey, would have been last year now. They would be different, but neither of them's going to be involved in this setup. If Jim was to take in, you know, even the likes of a Michael Murphy, even if it wasn't this year, if some stage, if he was to join in, the fact that we could get guys to be in Jim's standard. Now, obviously, they've played under him, but it's a very different thing then when you join the management team. So I'm hoping a few of those guys I mentioned join his backroom team and they could be managers for the future as well.
Yeah. Any idea of the backroom team? Any guarantees?
There's more texts flying about than I care to mention, but listen, it's all rumour mill at the minute. But hopefully tonight, I mean, normally the county meetings are Monday nights, Greg. There's a special one tonight. It can't be for anything else, but still up to delegates to ratify them. But I think this, I don't think there'll be anybody saying, oh, hold on a second. I think they'll be like, yeah, let's do it.
Right, okay. So obviously there's going to be some chat about that tonight, but the championship, kicked off through in at the weekend in earnest.
Yeah. And listen, we're always wondering, will there be a shock in there somewhere? And the games pretty much all went with who we would have thought. You know, I was just looking back at a stat. There's probably, I think it's eight or nine years since someone outside of what we call the top four actually beat a top four team.
There was plenty to spare in most of the games too.
There was, and I suppose there's a few teams now, even people say Niamh Connell and Unions are a bit ahead. Gidor have lost maybe six or seven players between lads away and a couple of injuries, and that's, they are badly depleted. Kilcare just tucked in, I think, behind the likes of St Unions and Niamh Connell. I was at the St Unions game on Saturday evening there against St Noel's. Listen, St Noel's again, you know, well organised, you know, committed, stayed in the game as long as they could. There was 3 points in it, with about 10 to go. You know, Unions eventually opened up. I was out at Glenswilly yesterday against Ardra. You know, Glenswilly looking really well as well. Like Michael Murphy, as you mentioned, still doing damage up front. Gary McFadden was brilliant for them. Copper.
You didn't get along to the 10-point thriller between Full Masters and Ayrua, no?
No, that scares me. Now, Peter Campbell was doing updates. They were just a wee bit ahead of our game, and I felt really sorry for him because at one stage he was hoping for a game to break out in the mid-late. That is a... Listen, it's a bit of a damning scoreline in terms of even the Glenfinn one, you know, Michael's won 5-5 on Friday evening. That was bad. Now 7-3 De Rua, both teams playing very, very defensive. Now again, Greg, going back to this thing of them getting ready to beat a bigger team. They think, right, well, that's the game plan. We have to play the guy. I mean, yesterday, strangely, our draw actually tried to keep three or four players up front. Now it left them a bit open at the back, which Glenswilly profited from. So what do you do? Like, I mean, to me, it's up to the bigger teams.
I suppose sometimes it depends on how you want to go out.
Yeah.
But do you want to go out? Do you want to have to go out having kicked 3 points? Or do you want to go out having scored 112, but, you know, them scoring 116? I don't know. It depends on...
Yeah. It's a tough one. To me, the bigger teams have to set the tone, and the bigger teams are still playing counter-attack. And, you know...
It'll be interesting again if Jim McGuinness calls managers together.
Yes.
Huh? You'd love that, wouldn't you? Well, he could send you out.
Yeah, well, maybe. I'll do what I'm told.
All right, come here. John Gilday, Gary McDade, both championship winners. They're on the show tonight. Interviews with Glenswilly Vice Chair Barry Malloy as well. The show's live just after 7 p.m. on Monday. Podcast tonight, podcast on highlandradio.com. The OB looked brilliant last week.
Yeah.
Lovely setup. Yeah. Really looked the part, actually. Well done. Sounded great too, which is the important thing. Yeah. But it's a great visual archive too. Yeah. People can check that out on YouTube, the DL debate. It was live from Sister Sarah's last week. All right, thanks. Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
That's okay. No, nice wee chubby Barry Malloy. You just mentioned there. He's a vice chairman out of Glenswilly. Just a wee bit of talk about what happened. Like, a lot of people wouldn't be aware of how much work goes on in the background. There's good things happening out at Glenswilly. Good performance yesterday, but a lot of good things happening around the club. So I talked to Barry about that, and I'll put that on the show this evening.
Yeah, Caller says, it's high time young players are given a chance to play for Donegal. There are many, many players that have never been seen that could play for Donegal. It's time we had serious scouts to find such players. Fact, they say.
Right.
Yep. Money will have to follow Jim McGuinness if we're to get back up there again. That's why Mayo are up there for so many years, in my opinion. Indeed.
Yeah, fanatical Mayo fans. Yeah, listen, counties, the major counties, it's terrible. You look at it, the counties who can generate the most money are actually counties at the top. You know, it's almost like a
chicken and egg, isn't it?
It is a bit, yeah.
Weather conditions on Friday evening, Glenfinn versus St Michael's was atrocious.
So. Yeah, listen, that's what I'm saying. The weather was terrible. I heard that. I was chatting to a couple of people was at it. So I'll give them a
Friday
pass on that
was
one.
Bad.
I'll give them a pass.
All right, Bren, you better go and get your show ready then. So fantastic stuff. Brendan Devaney, the DL debate is on tonight. Another packed show with a review of the club championships from the opening weekend. As I mentioned, the feedback, analysis and interviews across the big games. Brendan's guests on the show include championship winners John Gilday, Gary McDay, that interview as you mentioned there with Glenn Swilly Vice Chair Barry Malloy. It's all live after 7 o'clock tonight, and you can podcast then on our website highlandradio.com. Any views on all of that? 086 60 25,000.
The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
Caller says, I don't think Ireland had enough to win the World Cup. We could have secured free draws if it wasn't for an unfortunate own goal and a needless penalty. Wouldn't be enough to qualify for the next round, but would have been nice to return home as the only unbeaten team in the tournament. Okay. I think it's sad about Donegal not providing enough changing facilities for those with disabilities. I worked in retail for years, and back then, not sure if it's still the case, you were only required to get accessible toilets in if you provided food into the establishment. A shame if this can't change. Okay, thank you for that. Right. On a Monday, after 11 o'clock, we allocate a bit of time to talk a little bit more in depth about a topic, and it's called Monday Focus. And on today's Monday Focus, we talk to the Banking and Insurance MICA Redress Focus Group. They've been meeting with the banks and insurance groups on the financial shortfalls that families face in the new redress scheme. Sean McCabe and Sarah Shovlin are joining us now. Good morning, Sean. Good morning, Sarah. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Greg.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for having us.
Oh, no, it's our pleasure. It's really important. Sean, I might start with you, if that's okay. Where are the banks and insurance companies at right now in terms of what help or they might provide or what liability they might accept? Is there any movement from them at all?
We've engaged with them all, Greg, at this stage. We've engaged with all the major banks and indeed some of the smaller ones. Including the Vulture Fund. So the BPFI, the Bank and Payment Federation of Ireland, have facilitated a meeting with all the institutions, and we've put across all the necessary points that we feel at this time that is urgent. So short-term interim finance and all our finance facilities largely being to the fore. They have essentially at this stage, they are taking away our input, and they're hoping to come back with products and engage with the government to see if we can get financial products in place that people urgently need. And
yep.
We've stressed that to them. We've stressed that to them, that this is now an urgent matter. You know, it has been for some time, but before we met them, they had no clue of the gravity of this. So we're waiting on the banks to come back. They've given us verbal reassurances, but we have nothing clear, you know, in terms of products at this stage.
And the bottom line is this is born, is it not, Sean, from the fact that for a lot of people, if not all people, there is going to be a shortfall, and access to credit is going to be the option for most to try and make up that shortfall. And I suppose we would hope that the banks would see that it's their interest to have their assets returned to full value and would work with the homeowners. But then some might say they're just going to sit in their hands because the job's going to be done for them anyway.
Well, it's as a result of a failed scheme, Greg. We shouldn't have to engage with the banks. So, you know, it's a result of a scheme not being fit for purpose, as we all know. So, unfortunately, you know, we have to engage with the banks because people need to move on. And that's the general feeling amongst the public and indeed us, Sarah and myself, as defective block homeowners as well. So, yeah, so, I mean, the government and the scheme has failed us. So because of that, we've had to look for this alternative method in terms of engaging with the financial entities. And hopefully, you know, it's been quite positive to date. But, you know, I'm optimistic, but I'm cautious because we now need evidence of what they're going to do. And that's we're really moving from one phase to the next phase in regards to our negotiations with the banks. As I'm sure you appreciate, it's a very detailed, ongoing process, time-consuming, etc. And we're hoping now that they understand the issues. And from our first meeting, where they clearly didn't, across all lenders, and maybe even the government to a certain extent when we met with the minister. But now there is an acceptance that this is a necessity for people to move on with their lives. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's where we're at with the process. So, okay. We're optimistic, but cautious.
I'll come back to you. Sarah, I mean, did it surprise you in those early meetings, the lack of awareness that the lending institutions actually had? And can you talk us through sort of how you tried to let them know the reality for people out there?
Yeah, it was a real eye-opener for us, Greg, when we met with them on the 29th of May in the Banking and Payment Federation's office in Dublin. All the main lenders were there, and we basically laid out the reality of what's facing homeowners. Several of us within the committee have started and are already, you know, a significant way through this process. One of the clear things was that it's obvious that there's been little or no discussion between the government and banks. I would say, given that they didn't have any awareness of how extreme, you know, on the 90-10 scheme that we were all on up until a few weeks ago, how extreme the gap between the funding and the grant was. Like, we've engaged with the Irish Culture Banking Board as well, and those guys, their initial response was that, you know, there's 100%, and I quote here from a letter, 100% funded scheme will commence when regulated regulations are updated. So everybody is believing the government's propaganda that it is a 100% funded scheme, when the stark reality is that it's not. And a very obvious gap in the scheme is obviously the foundations. So any work you do to the foundations would have to be covered by yourself. But yeah, there are other gaps
We still haven't even got any confirmation in relation to a critical element of this moving forward. Sarah, I mean, it's kind of shocking, isn't it, that yous had to go up there, considering the amount of money the bank has on the table here, but also the responsibility many people feel they might have. It's astonishing that you had to go up there and say, this is the reality we're living in. And they're like, oh, right, didn't quite realise this. Why should it come down to people who are affected by this crisis to be making the banks aware? This should be happening, surely, at the highest levels within the housing department, within government, the financial department, whatever it might be. The government should be turning the screw on banks, saying, look, we'll levy you unless you do the right thing here, or we'll levy the vulture funds unless that you reduce interest rates. This is, I'm flabbergasted that it's people who are living in these homes that are falling down that are having to open the eyes of the banks and keep the fingers crossed that they do the right thing.
Absolutely, Greg. Like, there was some very simple low-hanging fruit that could be won easily with the banks. You know, for example, like, everyone who has a defective home needs to make their mortgage provider aware that they have a defective home, because that ultimately will be a certain risk factor to the banks, and those banks should be reporting that risk back to the central bank and the powers that be. But, like, you know, there's other things when you contact the bank and say that you can give them your report, and, you know, if you are a person who needs to be demolished, there is a default clause on everyone's mortgage that if you demolish your home, that you are in breach of your terms and conditions of your mortgage. Like, the banks need to be helping people through this whole process. And there is what is classed as a vulnerable client for the banking groups. And if you are a vulnerable client, that you've got some life event going on, and let me just say, there's no larger life event than potentially losing your home. You know, they need to be treating every defective homeowner as a vulnerable client, even having simple ways of contacting them on their website. You know, there was no dedicated line or contact centre for many of the banks in relation to MICA. And we found that when people were phoning up and talking to whoever answered the phone, that there wasn't a specialist and expertise knowledge of the scheme. The people in the banks didn't know anything about
the
scheme.
And you end up having the same conversation over and over again with a different person.
And people will say to you, well, what do you need the money for? It's 100%. Like, the propaganda has really worked. Everyone, you know, within the banks believed that it was 100%. And we know that it's not. So we have asked for a dedicated line to be sent up so that when people contact the banks, that they are dealt with, you know, in an appropriate manner, and that the person on the other end of the phone has some sort of understanding of the scheme and can talk the homeowner through what they need to do in order to be potentially able to release some credit for themselves.
Yeah, and it's hard
training,
to believe we're talking...
Training communication.
Yeah, it's hard to believe we're talking about really trying to get a loan facility for people when, you know, that's further debt, further... It really is crazy. And I'll tell you, and no one's going to convince me otherwise, banks' loan books do not reflect the true value of their assets. Someone said that they do. How could they? Because they don't know how many of their houses
they
are effectively worthless. So if I, in terms of a bank shares or their value or how their loan book is performing, no one can tell me that it's accurate because it can't, because it does not reflect the reality that much of the property in Donegal is worthless effectively. And they, I would say that's not reflected. So Sean, when you talk about optimism or hope, what is it? What could they come back with? What are they suggesting they might come back with to try and help their customers?
Yeah. Good question, Greg. And you touched there on the loans. So we're very much of the belief that any short-term interim finance loan should be 0%. And we've made that very clear. And we've made that public at the Oireachtas meeting on the 5th of July. So it's really important that people out there understand that we're not lobbying these groups to in any way help the banks profit from our misfortune. And I want to make that very clear today. So in terms of optimism, we're hoping and we're fighting for a 0% interim finance loan on a short-term basis. And we're also asking for other products for other people across the whole situation in regards to defective blocks. So that's people that need to rebuild their homes and are going to accrue obviously extra cost. And, you know, we give an example of that at the Oireachtas where there was a huge shortfall. Donna McDade displayed that very clearly at the Oireachtas meeting. I think the shortfall was over 112,000 to date. So that's one area. And then the other area is for people that are, they're going to have what I would call a larger than scheme cap size home loan shortfall, which allows people that maybe exceed the cost of the cap to also complete their homes, and then people maybe that decide to knock everything down, demolish completely, they also need. And very importantly and very crucially, our vulnerable members of society, the people that are in their latter years of life, the pensioners out there, they need to be helped.
Yeah.
And we really emphasised that we need what I would call sympathetic underwriting in regards to that. Mm. And that includes, as I mentioned, people in their latter years, and also people through no fault of their own have accrued maybe late payments or arrears due to the situation that they've found themselves in. And we've put that across to the Minister, Michael McGrath. We've put that across to the banks. We will put that across to the insurance companies as well as we move forward. But that's hugely important. Mm. So if people take anything away from today, I wanted to be clear. Not out there to in any way help the banks profit from our own misfortune.
And Sarah, like, there are some people that might feel that this is almost like waving the white flag that, you know, the banks.
Absolutely
are,
not.
No, I know
absolutely
that. I know not. It's not, Sean, but I want to say it now rather than read a text when you're off air, that in other words, you know, the banks should be themselves funding any shortfalls because until such time as the mortgage paid, you know, it's their asset. Let's put it like that there.
Go
ahead.
If the government scheme, Greg, was fit for purpose, we wouldn't be here today talking to you.
Yeah, indeed. Okay,
that's the bottom line.
And
we shouldn't have to go to the banks.
Okay,
we shouldn't have to go to the banks. Mm. So, you know, if the scheme was fit for purpose, and clearly it's not, fundamentally it's still not fit for purpose. It's not fit for all to enter, even though they've lowered the cost there to for testing, etc. But it's still not fit for purpose because there's still a shortfall. No matter what area of bill that you're in.
Yeah, well, at the Dole Committee meeting.
Auction 1 to 5.
At the Dole Committee meeting, we heard a civil servant say that he believed that this was a 100% redress scheme for most. And we heard Minister Charlie McConnellogue recently in his comments saying that he does believe this scheme is fit for purpose. You're not of the same view, obviously, Sean.
Well, I mean, we've given examples. We give very clear examples. It's on public record.
Mm.
And, you know, people need to come forward and also sort of back that up with the banks. But we've given very clear examples, build costings, detailed costings on Excel spreadsheets. I mean, we can't be any more explicit on that. There's a shortfall across, and I challenge anyone that says that they're able to do stuff based on current building materials cost, etc., labour, which will only increase with indexation and with availability across the county. Builders don't want to engage. My builder friends don't want to engage with the scheme. Why would they? They'd have to wait. So the shortfall, they'd have to wait for all sorts of payments. Tradesmen, etc., would have to wait. So, you know...
And you know as much as anyone, we all know they're up to their ears in work anyway. They don't need to be doing work that's that they have to wait months for their payment. Sarah, are the banks aware, or do they have an interest in the fact that this scheme as it stands is currently designed to rebuild houses on potentially, if not probably, defective concrete? Like, I wonder what they think of that. They have so much ignorance to this scheme to begin with. Do they realise that the proposition at this point is to rebuild houses or partially rebuild them on potentially rotten foundations?
I think one of the answers from them, Greg, and I might not be direct, but it's near enough, is that they said they'd be led by the experts. So, you know, you've got your engineer's report, so they'll follow the engineer's report. If the engineer's report tells you to demolish, then that's, you know, the bank is happy for that to happen. But I think where the big disconnect is that, you know, we have engineers saying that you shouldn't build on your foundation, and we have a government scheme that says if you take that approach, then that's on your cost.
Well, we have the CEO of Donegal County Councils himself, John McLaughlin, and again, I don't want to misquote him. I think he said if it were he would try and get the foundations done as well.
Correct.
That's pretty striking, that commentary. Sean and Sarah, you signed up for this to be part of this, and fair play to you, because it's incredibly technical and incredibly time-consuming, Sean, and incredibly frustrating along the process. But as you say there, Sean, you're trying to retain some optimism and see what they come back with. But it's a tough piece of work you, Sarah, and others have taken, I think, on as part of the focus group on banking and insurance within this scandal.
That's right, Greg, and thank you for taking the time to let us talk about it today. Can I just say to the public, like, I know it's very difficult. We're all dealing with this, and it's a hugely difficult issue. It's become a humanitarian issue. You know, it's beyond the housing crisis. But I would ask them to inform their lenders, inform their insurance companies, because currently the lenders and the insurance companies aren't keeping numerical statistics or figures around the gravity of this. And the more people we have coming forward and letting them know, then they can measure the gravity of it, and it prompts them to engage with us.
Really good.
So I would implore people, as long, I know how difficult it is, and a lot of people have literally, you know, stepped to the side because of the mental health and the stress and all the rest of it. And we totally are empathetic to that. As I say, we're defective block homeowners ourselves. But I would implore people to come forward, engage with the lenders, because the lenders to date, as Sarah alluded to earlier on, they aren't recording the statistics, so which they should be doing. And we're going to put this across to the central bank as well. And when we met the minister, he was very interested to hear that from our interactions with the banks and the financial institutions, that they aren't recording data. So if they're not recording data, the problem doesn't exist.
They should see a cluster of of problems in the northwest.
Exactly.
You go, hold on, we have to do something here. Sarah, is there anything that you want to add finally?
This redress group came together by a call out from Roisin and a few others looking for volunteers, and we're still very much looking for volunteers. There are many people out there with expertise, not just in the banking and insurance sector, but, you know, social media and other things like that, to try and keep the issue in the media and, you know, try and push for resolution for everybody to try and make this process a whole lot easier. So if you have spare time and you have an expertise, it would be really good to come forward and try and help out where you can. It's, you know, it doesn't have to be hours a week. It could be 30 minutes or an hour a month. It doesn't matter. Every little bit helps.
Sarah Shoflin, thank you for your time. I appreciate it. And not just your time in talking to us, but the time in what you and Sean are doing when you're dealing with this crisis yourselves. So Sarah Shoflin and Sean McCabe, both of you, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Greg.
Take care of yourselves, guys. Okay, that was Monday Focus. Over 43,000 people left emergency departments in Ireland before they had completed their treatment over the period from January to the end of May this year. The HSE figures show that 1,259 patients left without treatment from Letterkenny University Hospital, 1,065 from Sligo University Hospital. Now, of course, this is a huge concern that they're leaving, but we have to ask what are causing these delays. Martin Varley is Secretary General of Irish Hospital Consultants Association. And Martin, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg.
Bottom line is, you know, we speak to quite a lot of them that say, right, I've been there for 8-9 hours, you know, it's too uncomfortable, nothing seems to be moving, and I'm away home. And this is really, I didn't expect the figures to be as high as they are. I don't know what your view on it is, Martin.
Yeah, the figures are very, very high, and they're a major concern for consultants and for the Hospital Consultants Association. So we're very concerned about these figures. They indicate to us that patients are obviously leaving before the treatment is completed, and you have to ask the question why. I think the primary causes of this are actually the capacity deficits we have in our hospitals. We've been saying this for a decade or more. There are far too few beds in our hospitals, and we've far too few consultants. We're about 40% below the EU average on board counts. And in fact, when you look at our consultant numbers, the permanent consultant numbers we have approved in Letterkenny, up to 31% of them are not filled on a permanent basis. So that's a shocking figure.
Well, if you look at it like this, Martin, if we're 40% behind the EU average, and in Letterkenny, one in three posts aren't filled, in this part of the world, we're significantly below any EU average then.
You are absolutely on that count. And even when you look at the beds since COVID, since early 2000, the country has expanded the bed capacity in our acute hospital by about 1,000 beds. But only 69 of those beds have actually been opened in the West, Northwest, the whole Sylta region. So that's 7% of the beds being opened in the West, whereas you have 70% of the population. So again, you're falling behind, relatively speaking, even compared with what's been done to try and expand the capacity. So we're quite concerned, and we've highlighted this already and even in our pre-budget submission over a month ago, and we're calling on the government to put in place a rapid expansion of the capacity in our hospitals. Because if we don't do this, we will see a continuation of what we've been seeing heretofore.
But what do we do then, though, Martin? Because if I put that point to Stephen Donnelly, he would say 30 million extra went into the hospital last year. We've approved 31 posts, consultants posts. They're there. They're fully funded. You know, what else can we do here? Do you know what I mean? Like, so what I'll ask you, what else could the government do, even being local on it for a second, to fill those vacant consultant posts in Letterkenny before then you could even talk about increasing staff to support them and therefore increasing beds?
I think what you need to do is, first and foremost, recognise the fact that we're coming from a position of hugely insufficient capacity to start with. So putting an extra 30 million, whatever the figure, into the system is only trying to catch up on the deficit. So that has to be recognised from the get-go. Now, secondly, and very importantly, if one is to fill those positions, at the same time, expanding the capacity is crucially important, because consultants and frontline staff are finding it very difficult to work in conditions where you don't have the basic capacity to provide timely care to patients. So approving posts is one thing. Ensuring you have proper terms and conditions for people to work in is hugely important if you want to fill those posts and retain staff. And the difficulty is we're starting out with insufficient capacity. So people who are in a position to work anywhere in the world are looking at their options. Mm. And it's very difficult for people to ignore the fact that they might have better capacity to treat patients on time elsewhere. And that's actually starting to work against us as a country as a whole. And we haven't invested properly in our public hospitals for well over a decade, even prior to the financial crisis. So the catch-up is significant. The minister has said he wants a rapid build of 1,500 beds. We support him fully on that. He said he wants to open three or four elective hospitals with support and funding in that. He says he wants to open 6 additional surgical hubs to bring down the waiting list with support and funding. The difficulty is he doesn't have the money in the budget for that yet, and that has to be approved. And next opportunity to approve that is in the budget in October.
Mm.
So getting the working conditions right, just like you and I, we go to work in the morning, we want to know we can do our job. We want to know we have the basic facilities to do it. It's doubly hard to work when you don't have the basic facilities.
Well, look, we've been talking about that for years up here. You know, the comments from one former consultant went national in that he was sitting twiddling his thumbs because he couldn't do the work that he wanted to do. But these figures are people. Both you and I recognise that, of course, Martin. And, you know, in terms of the 1,259 people that left the ED at Letterkenny before the treatment was completed, like, what's their age demographic? Are these the older people that contact us? Are these the older people that say, I'm not going back there again? Are these the older people that their lives may be potentially, and not just older people, but their lives are potentially being cut short because they can't get a GP appointment and they don't want to sit for 14 hours in ED, and their families are saying, please, Mum, please, Dad, you need to go in and get looked at. And they say, I don't care if I die in this bed, I'm not going back in there. That's the health system we have now, and it's so scary and so worrying. Now, anyone who needs to go to the ED should, and they'll be prioritised if they need the assistance. But be that as it may, that's the perception that's out there, Martin, that it's not a place people want to go, and we don't know what that means for their outcomes.
Yeah, and that's a big concern, because while patients are triaged and hopefully those who have the more serious illnesses, the more urgent illnesses, are actually treated first, one cannot be 100% sure until one actually gets to sit down with the patient and do the full examination as to what the risks are. So there's always some risk there, and therefore we would advise people, if at all possible, wait for the treatment that you have arrived for. And of course, you're right, we need more facilities in the community as well. We need to be able to discharge patients from our public hospitals who have completed their treatment and have clinically discharged by their consultant and medical team, but we need step-down facilities in the community. Mm. There are about 600 to 800 beds annually which are actually occupied by clinically discharged patients who are waiting for step-down facilities, be it a home care, be it a rehab, be it a nursing home, whatever. But again, there's 2 or 3 wings to this operation that the country must get right.
Yeah, the only thing too is it a factor too, Martin, and this is not to get into any other sort of debate, but just a reality, that we have had a rapid acceleration in our population as of late. I presume that has to set us back even further, because there's a considerable increase in the population, like in multiples of percent, all looking to use the same facilities that are already under-resourced, 40% behind the European average. That has to... in other words, we need to almost redouble our efforts to account for that, I'd imagine, no?
We do, yes, absolutely. It's back to what I said earlier. We're playing catch-up here. Our population is growing faster than any other country in Europe, to my knowledge, and that has been the case for a long time, and has gone up even more in recent, in the last year or two, for obvious reasons. So we really need to redouble our efforts. And while the minister says he wants to rapidly build the extra beds in the year, this year and next year, if you don't put the money in the budget, that can't happen. Mm. And you need a very firm, highly focused plan to do it. And I believe it can be done, in particular in hospitals around the country. Adding on incremental blocks of beds is fairly time effective if one goes about it properly, but if we don't fund it in the budget, you're not even in the starting blocks.
Okay.
So we haven't got out of starting blocks, and we won't unless it's funded in the budget.
All right, Martin, thanks for your time this morning. Martin Varley there, Secretary General of Irish Hospital Consultants Association. We'll be back with your comments as we head towards the end of the show after this break. Now, some more. Oh, I've dropped it. Some more of you texting in your bills, your electricity bills, your most recent one. Now, there's a couple of dots missing, so I'm going to presume these are correct. I'm pay-as-you-go. My electric was €177.67 for 2 months. Another, my last bill was €520.37. Massive for summer bills, they are. A caller says, I'll probably be accused of being anti-LGBT, but because I am not, but an LGBT flag painted on an ambulance, this is just so wrong. I don't find the flag particularly offensive. I think it's just really maybe, and I'm sure, there are those who ride in ambulances to come and save lives that are members of those communities. And I presume it's nice for them if it's visible and they're recognised by their employer. I don't think it makes the ambulance go any slower or stops the sirens working or anything, but it's not something, and I say that not facetiously, though it sounds it, because it's not something I really would see as an issue. My experience with EDs, people who know people working in there are skipping queues. I sat twice with a relative and saw this happen firsthand. Now, it might appear that, but people are triaged and brought in dependent on their medical needs. I've not seen any evidence of that myself, but listen, if you've seen it and you believe that, I'm not saying you're wrong. Greg, does anybody think the banks give a damn about the people with MICA? They make you pay no matter what. Sean and Sarah, the banks know all the reality for sure. They just want their money. More electricity bills here. Hi, Greg. This is a breakdown of my bill, which I get because I have a smart meter. I also have Saturday Weekender, which means I've got free electricity from 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. I do all my washing, drying, and sometimes batch cooking on that day, yet I'm charged for laundry, according to this. I questioned this, and their explanation is that they know when I used my machines, and that is what the algorithm identifies. There are only two of us in the house, and I think it's too expensive for what we use. The price they have quoted for others is ridiculous, and that comes in from Bernie, which old smart meters, they're the best thing since sliced bread. Bernie doesn't use her washing machine unless she's on the free electricity, apparently. I wonder, maybe, do they have a limit as to how much you can use, and that's how they're doing you there. Well, the bill was €336, their bill, and this is a family now who are keeping real close tabs on how and when they're using their electricity. Cooking, €57. Entertainment, €45. Presume that's your TVs and what have you. Laundry, €39, though Bernie says she only does the washing when the electricity is supposedly free. The refrigerator, to keep that going, €39. Always on, so things that are on standby, you got your TV and stuff like that, €28. Lighting, decent value in lighting, €12 for the 2 months, although that is in summer. Probably use a lot of LED bulbs, Bernie, do you? But the other, which is probably phone chargers and stuff, is it? I don't know. €116, which could be anything. That could just be a little, you know, a little tax on a tax. But that bill in total, €336, that's from someone with a smart meter who's clearly keeping a close eye on things. So I just wonder, do they limit how much free electricity you have at certain times and they're sticking that onto you? Anyway, I don't know. Let me see. I wanted to get to this question as well. Hi, Greg and team. Just wondering, is it possible to get Donegal County Council to give an update in relation to the enhanced scheme? When do you expect the transitions to be completed? We are on the priority list to transition to the enhanced scheme, but it's been 6 weeks since the scheme opened. We resubmitted our request for information, which was requested on the 31st of July, on the same day, and we've had no response from them. I called DCC today to be told it's with the technical team and no date to be given as to when it would be processed. The opinion is that DCC are doing all they can, but yet we have been waiting so long. The delays are costing the homeowners just further anguish. Right, so what was the response? Applications under the previous scheme were at various stages when the enhanced scheme commenced on the 3rd of July. The council is now required to transition each of these applications to the new enhanced grant scheme. There are 1,296 applications to be transitioned as part of this process. Given the significant number of applications to be transitioned, the process will take a period of time, and we are working hard to complete this in the shortest possible timescale. The council appreciates homeowners' continued patience and understanding as staff manage the heightened workload during the transition period. So it's pretty clear. But what I read that to say is they're having to move each application one at a time at different stages and then marry it to the new scheme. And that is taking time and it's extra work for them. So as I say, that's not really maybe a satisfactory response to our emailer. But what it says is that they'll get to you when they get to you. But there is a, sounds like quite a long-winded process to get through. Right, 086 60 25,000. Don't forget, you can keep your texts coming even when we're off air, or if you're listening to us overnight. I was chatting to a lady in Letterkenny who says I put her to sleep every night. I wasn't quite sure whether to take that as a compliment or otherwise, but anyway, it's nice to know I'm beside you when you're tucked up at night. But anyway, if you are listening either to the pod or overnight, don't forget you can still text the show and be part of it, and we'll pick your messages up the next day and get them out for you. Okay, that's where we have to leave it on the programme for today. Thanks to Caroline Orr, who researched and produced the show, and Niamh working flat out, Niamh Shields working flat out on the show as well, looking after the socials and what have you. We're back with you tomorrow morning at 9. John Breslin's next.